From socialservice.sg, I'm Jing Yao. It has been more than 18 months since Singapore's first climate rally at Hong Lim Park in September 2019. In the COVID-19 pandemic, as we have documented time and time again in this podcast, has only highlighted and exacerbated existing socioeconomic inequalities in the country. With one of SG Climate Rally's founding members, Estella Ho, we talk about intersectional climate justice and the unequal effect of climate change. In addition, we also learn more about her activist and advocacy work with the movement in terms of her experience working with government agencies, working with other groups and organizations in the same space, and dealing with burnout. So Estella, tell me more about yourself, your role in SG Climate Rally, and how you got started as a founding member with the group.
I've been an organizer with SG Climate Rally since its inception in 2019. I've worked on various campaigns to push systemic change and a just transition to a net zero economy. And I think my current role focuses more on recruitment, internal capacity building, and building regenerative work cultures within SG Climate Rally or SGCR for now. I think my journey as a climate activist started in the summer of 2019. And at that time, I had a lot of pent-up frustration and grief surrounding the climate emergency. And I was convinced that what was needed to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius and avoid the worst impacts of climate change was really radical systemic change. And so I searched for an outlet to translate these emotions into action. And when I heard that a group of university students were planning to organize Singapore's first ever physical climate at Hong Lim Park, which is, of course, as you know, the only space in Singapore where public protests are allowed, I immediately reached out to them to offer my time and energy to the cause because they were approaching it from the point of view that they wanted to demand for the government to take bold climate action. And that was exactly the kind of systemic change that I was looking out for. To be fair, I wasn't really certain whether a climate rally was the best channel, especially since there is still a prevailing taboo surrounding activism of this sort in Singapore. But I knew I had to start somewhere, and I've been with the movement ever since.
And in thinking about, as you said, demanding bold climate action, right? So for a start, how should we, you know, for the listeners, how should we understand climate justice in the context of, you know, climate change and its unequal effects around the world? I mean, I imagine these are themes that SGCR grapples with on a day-to-day basis also.
Yeah, for sure. I think many people broadly recognize that climate change or the climate crisis has extremely far-reaching and devastating impacts. But I guess how it impacts various communities differently is less visible or less talked about. And I personally found it helpful to first consider what constitutes these unequal effects. And the way I've approached it is to categorize them into three ways. So the first one would be unequal exposure to the climate crisis, where certain non-human and human populations can face disproportionately high exposure to the physical impacts of climate change. And this affects their vulnerability to the climate crisis. So the way I was taught about how to think about vulnerability is your exposure plus your resilience equals your vulnerability. And I think in Asia, it's one of the regions that is most at risk of physical climate impacts, such as extreme weather events like droughts, floods, typhoons, all these things we have seen increasingly more visible in the past couple of years. But exposure isn't equally distributed. So according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, sea level rise resulting from climate change could displace more than 35 million people from coastal districts in Bangladesh. And as of now, many communities have already had their houses and foodstuffs destroyed by more extreme rains and floods. The second category would be unequal impacts of systemic or structural responses to the climate crisis, be it by the government, international organizations, or corporates. So, for example, the petrol hike by the Singapore government, while being framed as an environmental initiative to reduce the use of petrol-powered cars, is a regressive tax that disproportionately affects delivery riders and ride-hailing drivers who rely on these vehicles for their livelihoods. And given that there are no affordable or really readily available electric vehicle alternatives, they really bear the brunt of this policy. And the last category is unequal involvement in policymaking. So I think it's common knowledge that the younger generation will face the worst impacts of climate change, but I think because of their age, they often do not have avenues to influence policymaking in a meaningful way. And I think that's really what sparked the Fridays for Future protests and the virality of it across the world. And I think what makes these injustices is the fact that these unequal effects often bear disproportionately on groups that are least responsible for the climate crisis. And so climate justice is really about remedying these different forms of inequality. And this is the key principle of a just transition that actually Climate Rally is fighting for.
The IPCC and the petrol hike was just mentioned in the previous episode in our interview with PhD student Belisha Teo. She spoke of the contested framings of climate change and climate governance in Singapore, so be sure to check that out. And using this as the basis, right, you've very eloquently talked about the unequal exposure to the climate crisis, then consequently the unequal impact and the unequal involvement in policymaking. You then, you know, unsurprisingly make also the argument that climate justice alone is not adequate. And you've mentioned this and alluded to this, that climate justice has to be intersectional. So how do you understand intersectionality, and what do we mean, or what do you mean by intersectional climate justice?
The term intersectionality is about recognizing that social identities such as race, nationality, gender, class, sexuality, just to name a few, overlap, and this results in multiple intersecting layers of privilege or vulnerability. And intersectionality is important because it forces us to move beyond dichotomies and focus on the nuances of identity and really grapple with how these nuances determine the extent to which people are affected by climate change. And because of that, I think it also enables us to recognize the interconnectedness of the various social and environmental crises we see today. And we can trace how these crises, such as climate change and, for example, deepening wealth inequality, stem from the same extractive economic system. And we can start to unpack that such a system often leads to a spiral of degradation and deepening inequalities. A blunt way that one of the members of SG Climate Rally has put it is, if you care about the climate crisis, you have to care about the poor. You have to care about marginalized communities such as ethnic minorities or the LGBTQ plus community. And you have to care about those whose labor is being exploited in our current system. So for example, migrant workers, care workers, and I think the working class in general. And ensuring intersectional climate justice is deliberate is therefore looking at tackling these crises at their roots in an equitable and holistic manner.
Yeah, and someone will hear us talking about this and say, oh, a lot of these sound like, you know, this applies to contexts beyond Singapore. In fact, in many of your responses so far, you've brought in examples from Singapore as well. And in Singapore, you know, where have we seen examples of these unequal effects which you have documented, right? So I'm thinking, as you mentioned just now, about the petrol duty hike announced in the budget this year, and the statements and the many different petitions that SG Climate Rally has published so far. So where do we see examples in Singapore of these unequal effects, and based on, as you mentioned, the effects, the impact, and its involvement levels as well?
I'll start with a very general example. So I think low incomes, broadly, they are less carbon intensive. Yet low-income communities, for example, those who live in rental flats in Singapore and even the homeless, are the most vulnerable to climate impacts. Using rising temperatures as one of the physical impacts of climate change, I think when we are confronted with that, the most common thing for a lot of people with more privilege to do is retreating indoors with air conditioning, but not everyone can afford that sort of luxury and adapt the same way. I also raise the point about migrant workers in that they're more likely to be subject to extreme weather conditions because of the nature of their work. A lot of them work in construction, and that demands that they be outdoors and therefore exposed to the elements. For a more specific example, going back to the petrol hike, recently the Singapore government has introduced a petrol hike as part of the Singapore Green Plan, and this policy is ostensibly one that tries to promote environmental outcomes, but it is regressive in nature, and the burden of the tax falls disproportionately on low-income delivery riders and private car hire drivers, especially since no affordable and readily available electric vehicle alternatives currently exist. And I think when we saw this petrol hike, we realized how similar it was to the fuel taxes that sparked the Yellow Vest protests in France, which came about because a disproportionate burden of the government's tax reforms fell on the working and middle classes. And so we were very cautious about a situation where the workers are pitted against climate activists, which is why we launched the online petrol hike petition. You can still find it at tinyurl.com/petrolhike. And this was to emphasize that we are against the petrol hike and that we stand on the side of the workers. Even when we speak about raising the carbon tax or transitioning Jurong Island away from oil and gas activities, we always push for social interventions that alleviate the burden of this transition on the ordinary citizen. So this goes back to intersectional climate justice in that we firmly believe that climate justice has to mean social and economic justice as well, and that the cost of a just transition to a net zero economy should not fall on the working class. Through this petrol hike petition, are not only trying to mobilize public support, but we are also trying to center our efforts around the experiences of workers most affected by the petrol hike. So this means delivery riders and private car hire drivers. And several of them have shared their testimonies on our change.org petition. And if you go through them, you see that many of them talk about the economic struggles and precarity that they already face with the gig work that they do, and how this petrol hike poses an additional burden to them. And we use these testimonies as an anchor for our demand that the government gives workers a full rebate on the hike, not just lasting for a year as it is currently planned, and to make cleaner transport an affordable reality for them.
And it's interesting because the SG Climate Rally, I mean, the actual physical rally happened a year in 2019, a year before COVID struck. And then through COVID, in addition to the many socioeconomic problems we've seen, it seems to have also lent further urgency to the cause as well. And then you said this in an interview with Channel News Asia, and I quote you, and I'm going to quote you, and you said, "We have once in a lifetime opportunity because of COVID-19 to rethink and rebuild our economy in a way that makes sense for a low carbon future." So where do you or SG Climate Rally position yourselves in this process of rethinking and rebuilding and trying to make sense of this, as you describe, a low carbon future for Singapore?
SG Climate Rally is at the forefront of pushing for a just transition and intersectional activism. And that involves building coalitions with not only other green groups, but also broader civil society in Singapore, such as groups that focus on the rights of marginalized groups and social economic issues, so that we address the crises we see today in a holistic and meaningful manner, as opposed to, I think, the usual stopgap siloed solutions that focus on single issues only. I think we also have a role of recentering the discourse around reevaluating our shared values and desired outcomes as a society, not just around capitalistic or technocratic solutions that reinforce the status quo. And I think also with COVID-19, the entire world has had to take a pause and reevaluate the systems that have brought about these sort of crises that we see. And we recognize that these systems cannot resolve the problems that they have created. So what this means is that there is a much needed existential conversation that requires us to broaden the public sphere of engagement and activism. And that involves reclaiming our right to democratic forms of expression, even in Singapore. In the meantime, I think we also exist to push the Overton window, which means that we make policies and ideas that are currently on the fringe a part of the mainstream discourse. So one, I think, clear example of this is that we have been talking about a just transition since 2019, all through 2020. And in February of this year, during the climate change motion, the parliamentary speech by MP Gerald Young from the Workers' Party included the term just transition for the first time in parliamentary history. And it was used to bring attention to the need for social interventions to help enterprises and workers transition to a greener economy.
The Overton Window was named after American political analyst Joseph Overton and built upon by political commentator Joshua Trevino, also an American. In this framework and along a spectrum, potential policies or public ideas range from being unthinkable to radical, to acceptable, to sensible, to popular, and finally, to policy. Estella's description of pushing or shifting the Overton window could refer to endeavors to understand how public or societal perceptions change over time as they influence or are influenced by politics. And in saying that, I was going to pick up on that and say that I want to end with a series of questions about your activism and advocacy with SG's Climate Rally. But also that's interesting on that final point, because in Singapore, as we're familiar with, the government or the state plays an outsized role in policymaking. In this case, I guess I'm personally interested in what has your experience been working with the state or government agencies on climate-related concerns?
I think there have been two main modes of engagement, one being closed-door sessions and the other being public consultations, which is, of course, open to all. For the closed-door sessions, I think SG Climate Rally as a whole realized that engaging directly with government agencies or political representatives through these closed-door sessions may not be the most effective lever of change, because the public is completely removed from these sessions and they're not privy to the information that is shared. And that removes an important source of policy pressure. And I think also, given that we're a movement that advocates democracy, these very privileged spaces are also quite antithetical to how we envision policy co-creation to be like. And I think especially when it comes to engaging with government agencies, the agenda of these closed-door sessions are also determined by them. So when we enter that space, we are often already on the defensive, and that limits how meaningfully we can engage with policymakers. For public consultations, we, of course, do our research and we submit recommendations that are thorough in terms of their approach. But again, I think the entire public consultation process is still very much a black box, and it's unclear how sincerely these recommendations are taken into consideration. There's also a lot of public distrust in these public consultation processes because historically, I think the government has selectively used public consultation responses to support their agenda rather than using them holistically to reevaluate and shape their policy approach. And I think this goes back to my point on co-creation or the lack of it. And given these realizations over time, I think our theory of change has also evolved as we realize that our strength really lies in organizing and mobilizing public support as a means of exerting pressure on the government to move the needle on a just transition. And the focus, therefore, is now more on community outreach and organizing. Although we do still engage with the government through closed-door sessions and public consultations as and when they occur, because it is important to have representation and it is important to have a seat at the table. But the biggest takeaway for us is that we cannot rely heavily on these modes of engagement to drive the radical, far-reaching change that we need.
I was going to jump in just now, and just maybe not jump in, but also emphasize the, and we're recording this episode after I've spoken to Belisha, and she made, or rather I made a similar point in the episode about how being able to shape the agenda is important, because entering a consultation or discussion where you might not be able to co-create the agenda makes a huge difference because the terms of engagement are completely different. So I thought that was interesting that that was something that I think resonates not just within the climate space, but also across other social political issues. And I guess on your final point about pushing the government to move the needle and in working on community outreach and organizing, how does SG Climate Rally then work with the other groups or organizations who are working in the same space on these issues as well?
I think SG Climate Rally is always on the lookout for intersecting objectives or desired outcomes. And we have worked together with other civil society groups in terms of co-signing and co-writing statements and petitions in the past. We've also had intersectional campaigns that we've done with other civil society groups. So for example, for Greenwatch, which was our GE 2020 campaign, we invited speakers representing various interests and perspectives to share their thoughts on party commitments on our Instagram story in the lead up to GE 2020. And these speakers included Hecken Unicorn, which represents LGBTQ plus rights, AWARE, which focuses on gender equality, as well as other community organizers who work with low-income communities, and more. And in our scorecard, where we graded parties by their climate commitments, one of the key metrics that we used was to determine how much these commitments contribute to social economic equity. We also had this event called Activism in Crisis, and it was a civil society conference organized by SG Climate Rally, Speak for Climate, Foodscape Collective, Your Head La, and other organizations. And in October 2020, we joined a coalition of 11 civil society organizations to submit a report to the United Nations as Singapore was in the midst of preparing for its third Universal Periodic Review, or they call it UPR. So SG Climate Rally was one of the contributing signatories for that statement, and we contributed a section on climate change and environmental rights. I think what's most important in terms of our approach to civil society groups is to maintain and grow our network so that we can seize on opportunities to collaborate as and when they arise. And it's also a part of ensuring that there's repeated exposure so that we can acclimate civil society groups to the idea of intersectionality in the first place. Because I think it's a very new concept to many who are used to approaching activism from a single issue angle, or I think simply don't have the capacity to identify these intersectional opportunities.
I like that verb. I'm acclimatized, right? So I want to use that to kind of frame my next question, which is from the outside, I won't say from the outside, but for folks who may not be involved in the space, it would seem from the outside that the climate space seems to be dominated by younger Singaporeans. And you also mentioned in the beginning that that's part of the unequal effect, where younger folks are going to be the ones to bear the brunt of the effects of climate change. And so how do we acclimatize or bring in older Singaporeans and those who may be more blasé about climate change? How do we bring them into the fore and say, be a part of this movement and pay a lot more attention to the issues at hand?
So I think for me, the key ingredients to activism is firstly, getting people to care about the issue, and secondly, empowering them to do something about it. And I think when we think about bringing people into the fold of climate activism, it applies not only to the older generation, but when we think about how we should bring vulnerable or marginalized communities into the fold, to ensure that our activism is truly centered around their interests and concerns and not our own preconceived notions of what they want. One principle that we have found to be particularly helpful in directing our efforts is community-led organizing. So in part, that is about understanding what matters to these people and how we can relate to that. And that addresses the getting them to care part. And secondly, we also need to create spaces for them to engage in easy forms of activism by understanding their personal rhythms and finding ways to align some form of activism with those rhythms. So this feeds into then the empowering them part. And I think at a higher level, empowering these communities is also about gaining ground in terms of pushing the boundaries of democratic expression in Singapore so that people are less fearful about participating in civil society. I think there's still a lot of real and imagined fear surrounding activism that impedes meaningful engagement with the state. So I'm thinking of examples of Jonathan Wham. I think he's the long-term activist that has been targeted by the Singapore government because of his peaceful demonstrations, which have been termed an illegal public assembly. And I'm also thinking about the two young climate activists that held placards in public against ExxonMobil, and they were also investigated by the police. And I think the most recent example would be the LGBTQ plus or queer activists that stood outside the Ministry of Education building to protest against the treatment of queer individuals and queer students in schools. And yeah, I think a lot of it, these incidents help shape public perception of what is acceptable by the state. And that creates really a climate of fear when it comes to activism.
As a final question, I ask Estella about how members navigate work and life and other commitments, and also how the group has dealt with burnout and membership. You will hear her reference the Extinction Rebellion, or XR, a global environmental movement which uses nonviolent civil disobedience to bring about attention or greater attention to climate change and to encourage stronger government action.
This has definitely been a top of mind issue because many of our founding members have since graduated and started working. And I think while we still haven't figured this out completely, we are now being very intentional about making sure that the work that we do in the movement is regenerative. So at the start, I mentioned that I work on regenerative cultures, and this is about, I think, respecting people's capacities and making sure that the work that we do is rejuvenating and it's not exploitative. And we do this in two main ways. So we guard against the exploitation of passion in the movement. And we, following from that, we also honor the need for rest. And this is enshrined in our movement principles. And I think the precedent was set by Extinction Rebellion, or XR, the global climate movement. We have also assembled a team to work on building these regenerative cultures across the movement. The second part of it is about having clearly defined structures, processes, and roles so that efforts are directed and they feel meaningful. This is something that I think we had to grapple with in the past couple of months, but I think we are on the right track in terms of having these clearly delineated processes. And what follows from that is really making the space for teams to reach a consensus on how they would like to engage with each other. So terms of engagement are incredibly important, and also having avenues for grievances and honest feedback. And of course, making sure that there are ways to keep members accountable to each other such that the work doesn't fall disproportionately on people who may have more time and energy to dedicate to the movement. I think the whole point is that we center our structure and our systems around the well-being of our members, because they are the lifeblood of the movement. And the way that we have approached this is really to try to mirror the society that we want to live in.
Thank you so much for sharing, not just for sharing today, but for the work that you do personally, professionally, and also at SG Climate Rally. And I really look forward, and I look forward to the future activities and programs that the movement has in the future. So thank you very much once again.
Thanks for having me.